Doris Kearns Goodwin is an award-winning American biographer, historian, and political commentator. Her presidential biographies include Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream, The Fitzgeralds and the Kennedys, an American Saga, the 1995 Pulitzer Prize-winning No Ordinary Time, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, and Team of Rivals, the book on which Steven Spielberg based his award-winning movie Lincoln. Today, I have the honor and the pleasure of speaking with Doris on her most recent book, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism, a project that took 7 years to research and write. But first, a little history on Doris. She received a PhD in government from Harvard. In 1967, she went to Washington as a White House fellow during the Johnson administration. After Johnson decided not to run for re-election, he brought Kearns to the White House as a member of his staff, where she focused on domestic anti-poverty efforts. When Johnson left office in 69, Kearns went to Harvard to teach government. Concurrently, she assisted Johnson in drafting his memoirs. Doris's first book, Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream, was published in 1977 and became the launching pad for her literary career. Another aspect to Dr. Goodwin is that she is a mad, crazy Red Sox fan and was the first female journalist to enter the team's locker room. Doris, to borrow from TR, I am delighted to speak with you today.
Well, bully for us.
Bully for us. And first and foremost, congratulations on your Red Sox.
Oh, it was so amazing to be at that sixth game with everybody in your own hometown. And no, it hadn't happened since 1918 to win at home. It still feels good whenever I think about it.
Yeah. TR coined the term bully pulpit, but I suspect there are some listeners out there who are unfamiliar with the phrase.
Absolutely. And the important thing, I think, to understand is that bully in Roosevelt's term meant awesome or splendid or great, nothing to do with the current word bully. And pulpit meant that he thought the presidency had a platform that was unparalleled to mobilize public sentiment, to exercise moral authority, hopefully, to get the people in the country to do the things that were necessary to make America a better place. And especially in his time when the Congress was unwilling to act on a lot of the new things that needed to be done to deal with the industrial era, he could reach to the public and then they'd pressure the Congress from the outside in.
Doris, I myself am passionate about Teddy. I've read many of his books. I collect his memorabilia. I've schlepped my kids to Sagamore Hill. Am I correct in believing there has never been a more vigorous president?
Without a question. I mean, I tell you, just living by his side for the last 7 years, it was such a treat. I mean, he was so interested in so many things, you know, from birds to bears, you know, from Greek tragedy to Irish sagas. He wrote books. I mean, he was a world-class hunter, and he loved being president. I think, you know, you feel when you're in his presence, here's a man who would rather be doing this than almost anything else. Also had a happy family life. I suspect he was one of the most fulfilled presidents that I've ever lived with among the numbers that I did.
Right. And when you realize that he was a very sickly child, it seemed that he willed himself to be vigorous. I mean, this man took a bullet to the chest and continued speechifying.
No, it's really interesting because as a child, as you know, it was the asthma that was life-threatening, and his father said to him, you have the mind but not the body. You must make your body. And he also said as a child he was timid, so he willed himself to not be afraid. And that's really the essence of his character throughout his entire life. He said, you know, he was an ordinary man with extraordinary qualities of perseverance. He just worked hard at everything he did. And what's so encouraging about that, you know, we may never grow up to be a genius, as somebody else might be, but you can apply hard work to whatever you do. And that's what he did, and that's what made him this extraordinarily energetic character.
I so enjoyed reading the quote you cited from British Viscount John Morley, claiming he had seen tremendous works of nature in America, the Niagara Falls, and Mr. Roosevelt.
I know. It perfectly suits him. I mean, people never could figure out how he had the energy he did. And, you know, there was some thought that he drank a lot of cups of coffee a day, and he did indeed give Maxwell House the slogan, good to the very last drop. But I think it was just temperament. He had that fire from within that just really wanted to live life to the fullest.
Tell us about the relationship between T.R. and Taft, the early days. They seem like such an odd couple.
They were indeed an odd couple, but really close in those early days. I mean, I think in some ways they were both young reformers at a time when there was very little activity, especially in the Republican Party, to do anything about the problems of the industrial age. They were against corruption. Their fathers had been figures who cared about social justice. So I think that's what brought them together. But even their opposite traits seemed to bring them together. Teddy once said of Taft that he had the most lovable personality that of anyone he'd ever met, that he envied it because people loved Taft at first sight. Taft was a really amiable, kindly, smiling person, whereas Roosevelt said, it takes a while for people to get me. And then Taft just had such respect for Teddy's fiery language, his ability to prepare things so far ahead of time, whereas Taft was a procrastinator. But the thought of them walking side by side, it would be an opposite group. You'll never see Taft following Teddy on his manic walks through the woods or his boxing matches or his wrestling matches.
Taft was Secretary of War under T.R., but for all intents and purposes, he oft-times acted as VP. Teddy put him in charge when he went out of Washington. What was the reaction of Charles Fairbanks, the actual VP, and how did he interact with Taft?
Well, I think, you know, in those days, the VP really was so much less important than it is today. And in fact, when Teddy became VP, it was because they wanted to bury him in that office because he'd already been too active and reformist as a governor. So they thought, well, we'll just stick him in the VP. And then, of course, McKinley died and he becomes president. So Charles Fairbanks had a very, very small role in the running of the government. Secretary of State John Hay was sickly and actually died during Roosevelt's administration. So that was in part why the Secretary of War became the figure. But it was also because he was the person with whom Teddy was closest to. And you're right, when he would leave, he'd say, don't worry about things, Taft is sitting on the lid. And you picture this huge Taft sitting on the lid of all the problems of the country.
Hmm. You write that the progressives of the Republican Party were the precursors to the New Deal. Can you explain?
Yes, I can. I mean, I think what happened at the turn of the century is that the progressives were really the vanguard of the argument that the problems of society, whether they were monopolies growing and squeezing out small businesses or needs for reforms in the tenements and the immigrant slums, better working conditions for workers in factories, they argued that government had to be the force to better these conditions. And at the time, between the Civil War and the Progressive Era, there was this belief that government should have nothing to do with the social and economic problems of the nation. Laissez-faire was like a religious conviction. So they began to create the foundation of some of these laws. And then, of course, the New Deal takes them to a further degree during the Depression, making government an active force in social justice and economic opportunity.
We're speaking with Doris Kearns Goodwin on The Book Report. McClure's magazine was the engine of progressive reform. How so?
When I first started reading about progressivism in this era, I kept coming upon these historians who had studied it and who I remembered in graduate school I had respected so much, constantly referring to McClure's magazine as the most important progressive document of the time. So I started looking into it, and it turned out the reason was that they had a formula, which then other magazines followed, of giving their reporters, and it turned out legendary reporters were at McClure's, Ida Tarbell, Ray Baker, Lincoln Steffens, Williams Allens White, years to do their research, expense accounts that were big, and then they'd come out with exposés that were factually based and almost impregnable. Even today, Ida Tarbell's Standard Oil expose stands up. Ray Baker's understanding of what railroads were doing to squeeze out smaller railroads stands up. Lincoln Steffens' Corruptions of the City. And then when these articles came out, they'd be like 12-part series, and they created a common conversation in the country. And then Roosevelt became really close to all these guys. So together, between his skills with the bully pulpit and their skills in organizing people to start talking about these problems, that's where they were able to move the public forward.
I was fascinated by Ida Tarbell. She was so trailblazing.
Ida, at the age of 14, prays to God that she will never take a husband so that her nascent ambitions can be realized. She does go to college, the only woman in her freshman class at Allegheny, works on a local newspaper and local paper, and then decides she's going to go to Paris because she wants to write a biography of a Revolutionary War hero. And then comes McClure to Paris, having read one of her newspaper articles, to recruit her for his magazine. Their meeting is hilarious and funny. She then comes back and becomes really the mother hen of the magazine. And when she publishes her work on Standard Oil, she's considered Joan of Arc, the Crusader. There's a funny note in which somebody said that Rockefeller is looking all over for a man to take Ida Tarbell into his wife and his wife and take her around the world on a continuing cruise. But I had such respect for her. But the price she paid was not getting married so that she could have, you know, this career that really blossomed.
Hmm. And Willa Cather also worked for a time at McClure's?
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
In fact, one of my granddaughters is named Willa because my son and his wife loved Willa Cather so much. The other one is Lena. So she is a spectacular writer. And she, in fact, helped to pen McClure's memoir when it was later written. So he had an incredible group of people. And more than that, they had such camaraderie with one another. They would help each other with their articles. They lunched together. They went to each other's homes. So much so that later in life, after they were all broken up and not in the same place anymore, they would gather for McClure's birthday and remember this period as the happiest period of their life when, as one of them said, we thought we were changing the world.
How is it for you these days to be the go-to authority on everything presidential and governmental in our popular culture?
Well, as long as it's about the people that I've lived with, I'm okay. If somebody starts asking me about James Polk or Millard Fillmore, I might have a problem. But after you've, you know, spent so many years with, now in my case, finally 10 years on Lincoln and 6 years on FDR and Eleanor, and now 7 on Teddy and Taft, you do feel like you know them. And it's so nice to be able to think that history is relevant, that somehow we can learn from the struggles and triumphs of these people. Otherwise, we're learning our new problems all over again. It makes no sense to not look back, I hope, and see that they did it certain ways, certain things worked. Maybe we can try that.
Do you already have a next subject in mind?
The only thing I'm thinking now is to bring all of my guys together and to write something about leadership, because I there are certain traits that all these successful presidents that I've studied shared. And when I lecture, that's often what I share, what I often talk about. And it would be fun to live with them all at the same time, because I always feel when I leave one that I'm betraying the other, when I have to move all my FDR books away to make room for Lincoln, and then move all my Lincoln books away to make room for Teddy. So this way I can have them all together with me for a little while.
Well, I know there are millions of readers that will be waiting for that next book. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you very much.
All right. Bye.
Care.
Bye.
Bye.